dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased that we have with us a guest who is new to the program, but not new to the policy fights that shape, well, our country, our culture, and in important respects, our freedoms. Her name is Jean Messini. She is the president of the March for Life Education and Defense Fund. She has worked at the highly esteemed Family Research Council and also served in the office of the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services during the George W. Bush and the beginning of the Obama administrations. She knows a lot about that agency, and in particular, what its policies can mean for the most fundamental of our freedoms, the right to life. Jean, it is good to have you with us, especially at a moment when we are seeing the Biden administration seemingly determined to pursue very aggressively an anti-life agenda, if I can call it that, specifically with the appointment of Javier Becerra, the Attorney General of the state of California, to be the next secretary of the outfit you served in, HHS, or Health and Human Services. Tell us a bit about Javier Becerra. We should be concerned about his nomination.
Well, thank you, Frank, so much for having me. And let me say to your listeners, we should be extremely concerned about the nomination of Javier Becerra to this post. Number one, this is the single most important health post in our country. This is our health minister. He's got no health background. Nothing. What he does have is a very political background. So he's served in Congress for many, many years and voted unfavorably on all of the conservative issues that you would consider especially our issues. He's really, I would use the term an abortion zealot, frankly. I mean, I could explain that a little bit. He was also Kamala Harris's, he succeeded her as the AG in California. And in fact, that's where he is now, and hasn't resigned from that post yet, knowing that they're not really sure if he will get through as HHS secretary. But through his political posts, he has absolutely been so pro-abortion in so many different ways. So let me explain what I mean by that. One of my friends, David Delighted, maybe some of you have heard of him. He runs an organization called the Center for Medical Progress. You may remember him from about 6 years ago when his organization showed Planned Parenthood and other abortion organizations being involved in the trafficking of little hearts, little lungs, and little livers of children. And both Kamala Harris and then Javier Becerra went after David Delighted like there was no tomorrow. I mean, they, you know, raided his home, captured his computers, and have just spent so much money going after him in court as well. It's been terrible.
Really trying to destroy him professionally, if not in a personal way as well. Javier Becerra has as well, speaking of Planned Parenthood, a perfect rating from both Planned Parenthood and NARAL. And to the extent that he brings zealotry, but not any particular medical sort of skills to this portfolio, what might that mean in terms of the utilization of this secretariat and the, you know, department that it leads as a weapon in this war over life?
Right. So we're hearing, of course, the Biden administration using, you know, the language of unity, of course, but we're not seeing that at all. And so putting someone like Javier Becerra into this post is it's so anti-unity and anti-science, by the way, anti-health. But it will be such a political post. So remember, HHS has so much power over what happened. So so let me just say personally, I've worked in the office of the secretary at HHS during during a pro-life administration, and then I stayed for the first year of a pro-abortion administration in the Obama administration, and then left because of my pro-life views at the end of that year. And it was a very difficult year watching everything undone that had been done during the Bush administration. But there's so much potential for good or for evil, whether it's something as silly as a press release, really, and the language that you choose in that, but to the much deeper choices of who gets funded, and then the very specific language included in funding announcements. One word can make a huge difference in terms of what's allowed for grantees and what isn't allowed. And having, a lens of the respect for the inherent dignity of the human person can be carried through the entire administration, or the opposite. If we're going to politicize, everything and fund, the folks that you don't want funded, et cetera, that job has so much power. We can look back just really quickly on Obamacare. And under Kathleen Sebelius, they had so much power in interpreting one little part of that law, which had to do with contraceptives and abortifacients, et cetera.
Little Sisters of the Poor come to mind.
Yeah, right. And by on that, Javier Becerra sued the Little Sisters of the Poor in his California role, insisting that the religious order should be forced for these very things that we're talking about right now. So, and he's Catholic, by the way, and I'm Catholic, so it's so hard for me, to see these Catholics in these roles doing these terrible things.
Well, Joe Biden, for that matter, too, right?
Yeah.
So, just as an example of that, you saw them using the power of the state to try to compel religious orders that had conscience-based opposition to abortion, nonetheless being told they had to use their funds to promote or, essentially effectively facilitate contraception, in other words, interfering with life at conception. This was, it seems, an iconic moment, and I thought that the Supreme Court had resolved it favorably, but obviously there's an opportunity in such a position for a zealot, as you call him, Javier Becerra, to become another agent of sort of oppression of people of faith and of conscience who oppose these policies, don't they?
Absolutely. And with the Little Sisters of the Poor, that's just one example. I mean, basically, his whole portfolio, his career portfolio is this kind of advocacy. So he also, when he was in his role of attorney general, he sued the federal government so that California's health insurance would be able to include abortions in their health care plans, including forcing churches to do that. So, which is a little bit different than the HHS mandate, which includes abortifacients, but specifically that churches that have health insurance in California would be forced to pay for abortions in their healthcare plan. So he's got very, very radical views.
Jean, we're out of time. Just very quickly, what are the chances of beating this nomination, and how can people help do that?
I think that we have a small chance of beating it. And it's really important that we not sort of give this up. So the way that we can do this is to target two senators particularly. I don't think we have a chance. Manchin has come out against
Manchin of West Virginia
right now. Manchin, West Virginia. And then I think Sinema, Arizona, there's a possibility that she too could vote against this. So I think we need to very much target those.
Let them know your feelings, folks. Thank you so much, Jean Mazzini, for all that you do at the March for Life Education and Defense Fund. You're a blessing. We'll talk with you again with updates on this story, I hope, in the future. And thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Charles Jacobs about anti-Semitism on the rise in this country and elsewhere, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to Charles Jacobs, our guest for this segment, who is another good friend and very valued colleague from, well, it seems like several lifetimes ago, when he was working on things like redeeming slaves who had been taken prisoner and brutalized in Sudan and in so many other fights, including his tireless campaigning against anti-Semitism over decades. He is these days the founder and president of a remarkable organization in Boston called Americans for Peace and Tolerance. and he has been, an inspiration to me in that regard, and I'm always pleased to have a chance to catch up with him, particularly about the problem that we're now going to discuss, which is what's going on inside the American Jewish community that seems to be, well, fratricidal at best, and at worst, suicidal in terms of the sorts of threats that Israel, yes, but Jewry more generally is facing, in a world in which anti-Semitism seems to be once again, if not actually a revered practice, certainly one that is tolerated. Charles Jacobs, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back, and thank you for all you do in these important fights. And I want you to share with our audience how you see the present one inside the American Jewish community.
Well, okay. Thank you so much, Frank, for having me. I love to be on your show. So I'm here to talk about, you rightly described it almost as a civil war inside the Jewish community. And so let's back up a second. All of a sudden, the Jews find themselves, American Jews and European Jews, find ourselves attacked from four sources of blatant anti-Semitism. There is the alt-right, the neo-Nazis, white supremacists. There is the left-wing anti-Zionist, which you find on college campuses, and now increasingly in the Congress and increasingly in the mainstream media and in the, I don't know, establishment Christian churches even. And then you have the Islamists, whose Jew hatred one can find by Googling imams' speeches across this country in mosques. And then finally, you have the Farrakhaner, black nationalist, radical black anti-Semites who beat up Jews on the streets of the cities. So you have a Jewish community under pressure. And however, there's also in the Jewish community something that's echoing, is being echoed in America, which is a culture war. And this is spreading across America, and it's spreading across the Jewish community. So everyone who's listening to our show here knows that American institutions are being taken over by the left. You know, and from the outside, the institutions look like they always looked. The New York Times still has the same font, same building in Manhattan. But journalism, as we know it, and we knew it, is no longer being practiced in that building. You know, the news that's fit to print is not printed. On college campuses, they still have quads and lecterns, but classic literature, well, that's racist. You know, American history, sinful. Democratic Party is not the party of FDR. So progressivism is taking over basic American institutions, and wokeism is defeating classic liberalism. And phase one is when this is happening. And now we're into phase two, which is not only when they want to dominate the traditionalists, but when they want to eliminate them. So that's cancel culture.
And, you know, Charles, I find the term progressivism way too benign. I mean, this really is Marxism. This is a radical strain of the left ideology that is, as you say, now moving from intolerance and dominance to a desire to eliminate and, you know, canceling in the, you know, sort of social media sense of the word is, unfortunately, it seems, just the first step in that very ominous direction as well, is it not?
Yes, yes, yes. And I agree with you that Marxism plays a big part, but it's also, there's a cultural piece of this that Karl Marx would have just, you know, wouldn't have recognized. I mean, you know, the transgender business and the Black Lives Matter more than anybody else's life. I mean, this is in addition to the classical Marxism. So yes, yes.
But I would argue, and I don't mean to get too much in the weeds on this, Charles, but it does seem to me those are simply tactics that Marx would have been quite happy to see utilized for the same purpose that, you know, racism or class warfare or other techniques that he, you know, did contemplate were utilized, namely a divide and conquer strategy, are they not?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. He would have been really surprised to walk into a gender-neutral bathroom, though. Yes, I agree.
That may well be. So we've got four sort of vectors that are external to the Jewish community. And then you're talking about, well, there are some Jews in, of course, the second category. What is the particular threat that you're witnessing now, including, you know, this vicious assault against what I consider to be one of the most important of the mainstream Jewish organizations in this country, namely the Zionist Organization of America, under the leadership of our friend Morton Klein?
Yes. So as the left is taking over Jewish institutions all across, Morton Klein and the ZOA are the traditionalists. They're the pro-Israel people. They're the pro-American people. And they are trying to stop it. And they're after him. They want to destroy him. So in Boston, we have a battle which is kind of emblematic of what's happening across the country. So there's a thing called the Jewish Community Relations Council, which is a group. Every city where there are lots of Jews has these JCRCs, which try to unite the Jewish community and have good relations with everybody else. Well, they've been taken over by the left. And the hard left is called J Street. That's an organization that we've made a film about that pretends to be pro-Israel, but really sides with the enemies of Israel because it blames Israel for the conflict with the Palestinians. And as you know, that's the new anti-Semitism, right? The old anti-Semitism is that, you know, the Jews were committed deicide. The Jews were, from the Nazi point of view, racial vermin. The new anti-Semitism is that Israel is the Jew among nations and the worst place in the world. So that's how you can hate Jews today, not so much because of the incidents with Jesus Christ or because of racial business, but because the Jews have the so-called apartheid state of Israel. That makes it okay for you to be against Jews. And Klein is one of the main leaders against all of this, and he is confronted by a Jewish left, which is getting more and more powerful, which has decided to embrace the American left and its cut and become actually part of that. And it's they're embracing a left that is now kicking the Jews in the teeth.
You know, a prime example of this, and I know he's been involved in, you know, metaphorically, hand-to-hand combat with this group called Hayas, which was once upon a time known as the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society. Talk a little bit about what Hayas has become as a sort of prime example of this transformation that you're talking about, Charles Jacobs.
This is very dangerous for Americans and for Jews. So Hayas ran out of Jews to import, right? It used to do magnificent work helping Jewish refugees who were really, really in trouble around the world, bring in to America, and they kind of ran out of Jews, or most Jews. So what should they do? Close up shop, stop the income, relinquish all those wonderful salaries? No, they just get new customers. And they've got the conveyor belt going, and the new customers just happen to be people from what is documented to be the most anti-Semitic cultures and regions in the world, that is the Arab Middle East. So Hayas now imports Syrian refugees. And as I have written and researched, every Syrian child goes to a state-run Syrian school, and they have learned that Jews are the sons of monkeys and pigs, and that to kill them is a pretty good thing to do. So Hayas is bringing into our neighborhood these people. Now, America does not vet.
And getting paid handsomely for doing it, by the way.
Oh, and getting paid handsomely. And not only getting paid handsomely with cash, but they are virtue signaling their way to the top of the heap of the of morality, because they say to the Jews, after all, we were refugees, and so we have to be for every refugee the same as we were for our refugees. Universalism en masse.
And they've even dropped Hebrew from their name, as I understand it. It's
right.
Just the acronym.
They still use the H. I don't know why they use the H.
Because Pious is a brand. That's why they use it.
It's a brand, right?
Yeah. So, Charles, very quickly, the cumulative effect of Jews embracing and enabling rising anti-Semitism is, as I say, at the very least, fratricidal, but it's potentially suicidal as well. And it does seem to me that there's an urgent need for a course correction. And I commend what you do day in and day out at the Americans for Peace and Tolerance to both hold up a light to what's going on here and challenge it and help those like Mort Klein, who are similarly standing up against it and being badly beaten up for doing so. These are the sorts of things that I think really commend to our audience and other Americans, your organization. How do people find out more about your work at Americans for Peace and Tolerance?
They can go to Peace and Tolerance. One word, peaceandtolerance.org, and they can see everything that we do.
And films they would be, and books and essays and campaigns. It's a fabulous resource, as is the organization and its leader. Charles Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us today. Come back to us, if you would, with updates. This is vitally important work, and we appreciate your doing it so much, sharing it with us. Next up, we'll speak with David Wormser, who is working on the anti-Semitism beat as well at the Center for Security Policy, specifically the validation culture that seems to be enabling anti-Semites, including inside the Biden administration. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're going to continue on the topic of anti-Semitism with another of our duty experts on the subject, my friend and colleague, Dr. David Wormser, who is a senior fellow and director of the Project on Global Anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel Relationship at the Center for Security Policy. He has served in a number of other capacities of note. He is a lieutenant commander, now retired, in the United States Navy Reserves, where he served as an intelligence officer. He has also served as the Middle East policy advisor to then Vice President Dick Cheney. He's always welcome here. David, good to have you back. Thank you for joining us. So, you've written an important piece, David, at American Greatness, an online resource that I commend to all of our listeners, entitled Validating Anti-Semites in Power. We, again, set the predicate for why anti-Semitism is a bad thing, if anyone needed to be reminded of it. But talk to us about what's being done to actually put people who espouse such views into positions in which they can shape policy for the United States government. What's up with that?
Sure. We all focus on cancel culture, as we ought to, where people who said something unguarded when they were 3 years old suddenly have no public or no job anymore. But there's an equal sort of campaign to shape the language and on the left going on, and you see it with the validating of certain ideas that should never be validated. Of course, the highest form of validation is to appoint somebody to senior public office in the United States. This signals this is a reasonable guy, his views are reasonable, and so forth. So what we see in the Biden administration is a number of appointees who are clearly either anti-Semitic or so hostile to the Jews that it raises questions, or so hostily anti-Israeli that it really raises questions. I think most dangerous is the one who is now in charge of all intelligence in the White House. Maher Bitar, the senior advisor on intelligence in the White House, is the coordination. It's the connecting tissue between the entire intelligence community in the White House at universe, which is the president, vice president, et cetera. They are the ones who are the filter through which everything passes. Now, this Maher Bitar, apart from being involved a decade or two ago in anti-Semitic activities, including working as one of the leaders of the BDS here at Georgetown University, and writing a very odd and...
Now, BDS, of course, is Boycott, Divest, sanctions. And you might just say a brief word about why that's anti-Semitic.
They hide behind the idea that it's normal to criticize Israel. Every nation should not be above criticism. Something, of course, with which we all agree. Every nation should be subject to criticism when criticism is due. The problem with this BDS movement is that they believe that Israel's existence is a crime, and therefore their boycott, the divest and sanction program, is to boycott, divest, and sanction every Israeli or Jew that is connected to Israel. It even extends now that you have these radical leftist Jewish organizations who wanted to be part of the Million Man March, who were boycotted because they were LGBT, lesbian, gay, trans, whatever the alphabet soup is. They were part of that movement, and they were banned from the Million Man March at the behest of the BDS movement, because they say that the Israelis pinkwash LGBT communities. So here are radical leftist Jews who hate Israel and have a long history of hating Israel, who are banned by BDS from being in the Million Man March for no other reason than they were Jewish. That's anti-Semitism.
Well, this is a piece of what we've been talking about with Charles as well. But David, to this point about Maher Bitar, I think we've got real reason to be concerned, having an individual with these credentials and background and proclivities, being, as you say, the filter not just for Middle East-related intelligence, but all intelligence going into the National Security Council, for one thing, but also into the White House as well. This is deeply troubling, and yet I've heard almost nothing about this nomination other than what we've been talking about. Not nomination, this appointment, I should say.
I mean, here's how disturbing it is. He, up until a few years ago, worked at the UN Relief Works Agency. This is a UN body entirely dedicated to Palestinian refugees and education among Palestinians. But lest you think that it's really just about education, in 2014 and in general in the last decade and a half, UNRWA, this UN Relief Works Agency, UNRWA was the structure through which Hamas would use schools, these UNRWA schools, as launching bases for missiles into Israel and storage of weapons depots, something that was obvious. It was obvious to everybody who was watching. It was an inescapable thing. It's like Saddam's baby milk factory. And UNRWA clearly knew. They had to know. Their own schools were missile launching sites.
And just to put a fine point on it, David Wormser, the reason for doing that was to make them essentially invulnerable to retribution from Israel, to neutralize those assets. Yes, human shields using children, for heaven's sake.
Exactly. Now, the key is the head of UNRWA was well aware of this, and the Israelis later revealed he was complicit in this. A non-Arab, he was an Irishman, I think. He was complicit in this. He was deeply hated. He hated the Jewish state. So he was complicit in this. Now, why do I raise this? Because Maher Bitar was working in the Jerusalem office of UNRWA at this time. Now, here's the head of intelligence. Either he did not see something that was painfully obvious to everybody, which is a horrible recommendation for an intelligence officer, or he knew and didn't want to do anything about it, in which case he agreed with it. So
this is right. So give us just another couple of data points on this, if you would.
Okay, so we have Rima Dodin, who's now the Deputy Director of White House Legislative Affairs, the connective tissue to Congress. She was also part of the BDS movement. Corinne Jean-Pierre, she goes around bragging that no Democratic presidential candidate will ever talk again to AIPAC, the main Jewish lobby in the United States. She was the one who made sure that didn't happen. Very proud of it. She also, every time she accuses them of horrible activities, of being Islamophobic, et cetera, evidence for which does not exist. Then there's Kristen Clark. She's disturbing on so many fronts. We've seen about her racial theories. I believe Tucker Carlson has focused on her for that. But she also has a deep history of bringing anti-Semites to Harvard to speak when she was there. And these were people who
And what role is she being nominated for?
She's the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. She's the number two. She's basically in the top tier of the in the Justice Department, exactly. And she not only brought these speakers who talked about Jewish conspiracies, horrible Jewish conspiracies, right out of the books of Nazi propaganda, but she also then afterwards praised them. This Professor Martin, one of the ones she brought, she said is, quote, an intelligent, well-versed black intellectual who bases his information on indisputable facts. When this, that's what she said, that's her quote. And what this Tony Martin professor said was, the Jewish tradition and the Jewish people who hold a monopoly on centuries worth of the notion of divinely attained African inferiority, those so-called sages of the Babylonian Talmud were the earliest racists of recorded history. So this is indisputed fact, according to Kristen Clark, who now is number two, essentially, in the Justice Department.
As you say, with myriad other very problematic views and personal, you know, experience as well. David, I just want to close out this really important conversation by again commending to our listeners your piece about validating anti-Semites in power. And you make a very interesting, and I think very astute observation that we're all now hearing about, and many of us are being subjected to, this cancel culture. You point out that there's a validation culture as well. And that's what's really going on here, is it not?
It is. I mean, it's a 1-2 punch. Those who don't have the right views are canceled. Those who have really horrible views that generally decent American society, the fundamental decency of American society had made taboo. I mean, we tolerated Nazis marching in Skokie because we're a free country. But Nazis were not tolerated as a normal political view in this country. It was taboo. This validation is the flip side of cancel culture. It's to make credible certain views that should never be credible. And then you cancel those views that are credible, that are what really are the bread and butter of American decency, and cancel them. So it's a 1-2 punch.
It is a part of the larger takedown strategy, it seems to me, against our country. And we're going to be talking much more about that in the days to come, because unfortunately it seems it's really the leitmotif. It's the general sort of operating code of the Biden administration, Biden-Harris administration. And it demands our criticism, it seems to me, and also our strong opposition. And we appreciate your leadership in that regard. David Wormser, the Center for Security Policy's Project on Anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel Relationship. We'll be talking with you again next week. Thank you, my friend. Be well. Next up, we'll speak with Suzanne Katz-Keating about what's up with the military of the United States and more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say once again that we are joined by Susan Katz-Keating. She is an award-winning author and a very highly accomplished investigative journalist with the beat of terrorism and national security, currently at a terrific news organization, John Solomon's JustTheNews.com. She has experience in a variety of other news outlets over her distinguished career, including at Time Magazine and The Washington Times, even People. She has been breaking some important stories at Just the News, and they relate to some of the things that I personally am very concerned about in terms of what's being done to our country and some of the most important institutions, not just for safeguarding its security, but really for holding up for all the rest of us the values and the qualities that have made America the great, exceptional nation that it is. And I'm thinking specifically of the United States military, both those men and women who are currently serving and veterans who have now increasingly come under assault, as Susan Katz Keating has been documenting, from the left, from people who seek to vilify those who are accused of being supporters of, the Constitution. And certainly the former president of the United States, Donald J. Trump. Susan Katz Keating, it's great to have you back. Thank you for taking some time with us, as always.
Frank, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
The pleasure's mine. So let's talk a little bit about a piece that you had in the Just the News entitled, "Ex-Military Are Miscast as Dangerous in the Wake of the Capitol Riot," veterans say.
Yes. I would love to talk about that.
I'm concerned that what is happening here is not an isolated problem, but part of this larger practice of canceling and, ultimately eliminating, including perhaps from military service, people that are afoul of sort of the party line politically of the Biden administration or its friends. Talk a bit about what these veterans you've been talking to are telling you about what's being done to the military in this regard.
I spoke to quite a few veterans, Frank, and they are universally concerned. First of all, they're saying that if you broke the law, you absolutely should pay the consequences. If you assaulted someone or if you destroyed property, you own that and you should pay and you should be held accountable. But what they're saying is that all veterans are being cast widely, particularly if you see in media reports, this whole breathless, they're putting their military training to use and they put it to use in assaulting the Capitol. And what the veterans are telling me is, like, first of all, tongue in cheek, but also that they're serious, that if veterans had really been involved in an organized way, they would still be holding the Capitol. They're saying, we didn't organize this, and it's not a veteran-wide movement to take over the government. And what they're pointing out is that veterans are pretty much, in the military, they're used for political purposes. So if a candidate wants vets and if it's to his or her good purpose, they'll praise the vets or they'll do the opposite. They'll demonize the vets, and it's very troubling, and veterans are deeply concerned about this.
Are they concerned specifically about how people like them, people who have served their country, almost always, honorably, if not with great distinction, are being characterized as, domestic terrorists or insurrectionists or enemies of the state or any number of horrible things. Christian nationalists is another one that's sometimes used. And to what extent, as they hear that, are they finding themselves now more broadly consigned to a kind of, untouchable category that is not how they are generally regarded by the American people, nor should they be.
I think it's what it's doing is it's driving them closer into their own ranks. There's a dynamic where people will say, veterans will say, well, we only trust other vets. Now, even if other veterans did something wrong, we understand them. Like, we know who they are and we have shared experiences. And I think what it's doing is it's deepening a cultural divide between people who actually volunteered, because it's an all-volunteer military. They stepped up and said, absolutely, I will be there to defend my country. And then others who allow themselves to be defended without participating in that defense. And I think it's just it's deepening that cultural divide. And it's not fair to the veterans because it miscasts them. And I've said this before, they're your neighbors. They're the people next door. They're the people your kids went to school with, their kids. They're ordinary Americans. And yet they're being portrayed as potentially dangerous because they have weapons training.
Even though, by and large, I think it's fair to say they understand the necessity for the most constrained handling of weapons of anybody. And of course, the broader implication of all of this, Susan Katz-Keating, is that those who are serving today are now being similarly vilified, at least in some categories. We're hearing the Secretary of Defense himself, a former veteran, now talking about purges of the military and doing, you know, exhaustive investigations into those who serve. This would seem to be of a piece with the other problem and very troubling for the good order and discipline of the United States Armed Forces, is it not?
It is, because it puts the military members on the defensive. If they are being looked at as if they are a potential terrorist, potential lawbreaker, they have a secret hidden agenda. It's not fair to them. And that, you know, you can't help but be affected by that. And what I find so remarkable is that this look into the character of the armed forces seems to be going down one path and not another. So when you hear the defense leaders talk about this so-called problem that they don't know exactly how widespread it is, they talk about white nationalism and extremism. They don't talk about any other kind of extremism. They don't mention Nidal Hassan, who was he was a radicalized jihadist who killed other soldiers. But they don't talk about that. They talk about the shadowy problem of white extremism. And this is not to say that somewhere it does not exist. Like, the military is a big, 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 big animal. And of course, you're going to have a wide variety of people in it. But to take that leap from saying you've got like three skinheads in a unit somewhere to meaning that the entire military is flush with these people is a big leap, and it's wrong.
It is wrong. And deeply injurious, I think, to the institution of the military, as well as to individuals who are being treated in this fashion. Let me turn to one other topic. A former military member who is a transgender woman has been subjected to some seemingly outrageous mistreatment in jail after her arrest in connection with the so-called riot in the Capitol as a member of a group called Oath Keepers. You've just reported on this at Just the News. Talk to us, if you would, Susan Katz-Keating, about this woman, Jessica Watkins, and what she's been going through.
This is a woman who, as you said, is transgender, who was arrested and charged with being a ringleader in events at the Capitol. And apparently, according to a law briefing filed this weekend, she was injured and she needed medical help. And she asked for it and was refused help and went on a hunger strike. And so the response to the hunger strike, the lawyers say, is to strip her completely naked and leave her in the cell for 4 days in that condition. And that was a pretty, pretty stark and pretty brutal treatment of someone, just for essentially wanting medical treatment.
This is a subject I imagine we will need to return to. We're out of time for today, but Susan, thank you for the work you do at justthenews.com and for the organization of which you are a part. It is doing incalculably important work in covering stories that are generally not getting the attention that they deserve elsewhere, and we are so grateful to you for coming on periodically to update us on what you're finding and reporting on. Let's keep it up. I hope that the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.